The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is the Bloomberg Business of Sports Show. We explore the big money issues in the world of sports. I'm Michael Barr.
I'm Scarlett Fu.
And I'm Damian Sassauer.
On the show today, we talk compensation for student athletes.
We'll hear from Jim Cavell, who started a platform designed to help student athletes build their personal brands and navigate NIL.
All of that is straight ahead on the Bloomberg Business of Sports Show. But first, we hit on some of the big headlines this week, starting with the sale of the NBA's Phoenix Suns. The details of a $4 billion deal for Matt Ishbia to take control of both the Phoenix Suns and the WNBA's Phoenix Mercury are being worked out. For more on what we know, we turn to Bloomberg's Brian Chipata. Brian, thank you so much for joining us on the Bloomberg Business of Sports.
Thanks. Yeah, big deal indeed.
Oh my goodness, here we go, another big deal, more billions and billions and billions of dollars. This isn't going to stop until the earth stops spinning.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's really interesting about this deal is, you know, for $4 billion, that's pretty high for the Phoenix Suns. Some of the valuation services out there had them at roughly $3 billion. I mean, just last year, they were valued at $1.55 billion in a minority sale. So when you think about $4 billion, it really goes to show kind of just how frenetic the pace is right now among the billionaire class trying to get a sports franchise, frankly.
And Matt Ishbia, who is going to take control of the teams, what do we know about him? Yes, he's a billionaire, but I don't recall seeing his name come up a lot as a potential buyer for any of these franchises that do come up for sale.
Yeah, he's been in the background for a few of these franchise sales, so it seems like maybe this was the one where he really just threw the highest number that he could just to lock one down. He became a billionaire via a SPAC sale during their heyday in 2020. His father founded United Wholesale Mortgage back in the mid-1980s, but it was actually just the SPAC sale that made him a billionaire. It was actually interesting because it went public via SPAC through Alec Gores, who is the brother of the Detroit Pistons owner, Tom Gores. So there's actually a lot of really interesting connections when you actually dig a little bit deeper into Matt Ishbia, who himself was a walk-on basketball player at Michigan State.
Bart's ears just perked up, by the way.
Yeah, when you said Michigan State and the Detroit Pistons, and I'm sorry.
And Tom Izzo. No. Please continue. No. So Brian, for me, the real question here is, if I'm reading this correctly, $4 billion price tag gets both the Phoenix Suns and the Phoenix Mercury. Of course, Brittany Griner plays for the Mercury. But, you know, if you look at it relative to what Joe Tsai paid for the Brooklyn Nets back in 2019, which was $3.3 billion, he also got the Barclays Center. And I don't believe, this deal includes a stadium. So I wonder, I mean, is this price tag right? Is it possible that that Matt Ishbia was overpaying for the Suns?
I mean, like I said, it does seem pretty high relative to where the valuations of the team were just last year in the minority sale. I mean, one thing to note is I believe that Joe Tsai got basically control of the entire Brooklyn Nets franchise. He had already owned 49% and just got the other 51%. Our understanding with this deal is it's somewhere north of 50 for Matt Ishbia and his brother Justin. Possibly around 60%. So when you think about that, the actual overall cost for them straight up in terms of the franchise is probably ends up being roughly around the same as Joe Tsai paid for his stake. So, we're kind of hesitant to call it. It's definitely one of the biggest deals ever in the NBA and obviously one of the biggest deals in any professional U.S. sport league. But it's kind of in that ballpark. But to your point, I mean, the Nets are a more valuable franchise, and especially when you throw in the Barclays Center real estate on top of that.
This is a little delicate question, but the WNBA's Phoenix Mercury, and because of the Brittany Griner story, now that team, obviously, many people know about the Phoenix Mercury. Forgive me for putting it this way, and thank God that Griner's back home now in the U.S. Has the valuation of that team just simply from the publicity raised the valuation of it?
I mean, that's a really interesting question. And one of the things that, I was trying to figure out, but unfortunately we just have no insight into it just yet, is kind of the breakdown between kind of the valuation of the Suns versus the valuation of the Mercury in this whole package deal. Because Robert Sarver owned both franchises, obviously, and now the Ishbias will as well. But I think the moral of the story, as you guys have chronicled throughout this past year, is that women's sports has become much more high profile. There's been a lot of focus on it, and there's been a lot of money thrown in the space in anticipation that it will only grow. So I think it stands to reason that the Phoenix Mercury's valuation will likely to continue on the trajectory that broadly women's sports has.
There's another big sports story. The Masters says LIV players can now also play in the Masters coming up in Augusta straight ahead. About 16 players involved. What does that mean for the marriage of the PGA and for LIV golf, or will it still be estranged? Let's put it that way.
I mean, I think it would have been really a bad look probably for the PGA if they were to ban them. I mean, my understanding was that, you know, if you qualified, you know, you're in, and I think you have to just, it's a really tough situation for the PGA, because I think its line has been, we want to do what's best for golf long term. And I think kind of, you know, being punitive would kind of diminish that stance a little bit.
The Masters needs to show its independence, right?
Yeah.
It's not beholden to the PGA.
Yeah, exactly.
What this does do is it opens the door, obviously, for players like, you know, Bryson DeChambeau, Brooks Koepka, Sergio Garcia, past winners, and, you know, people who have won other majors like Cam Smith to participate in the Masters. But what does this mean for the FedEx Cup? What does this mean for the balance of the PGA Tour over the course of 2023? I think that still remains in question.
Special thanks for Brian Giappana for taking us through that story. Now we turn to the NFL, and they just inked a big deal granting the rights to their massive Sunday ticket package to YouTube. For more, we turn to Bloomberg's Chris Palmieri. Chris, thank you for joining us on the Bloomberg Business of Sports.
Anytime.
This is huge. I mean, we have talked about many streaming services joining sports, and from football to baseball, whatever. But this is huge, especially for YouTube.
Yeah, you know, this is in a way sort of a symbolic passing of the torch. I mean, DirecTV, which was the current rights holder, was an innovative satellite TV service in its day, but they just couldn't afford this anymore. And so now we have YouTube TV, which is an online equivalent of cable TV. You know, you pay $65 a month and get 100 channels, but it's all streamed. And they're taking over the reins for this in a 7-year deal.
Chris, it's an old man like me. It's like, you know, if I still have the old rabbit ears TV, it's like catch up, Grandpa, because it is passing you by. We know you love sports, so you better get on the streaming bandwagon here if you want to watch what you have to do. But, man, it's so many platforms out there for sports fans to follow.
You know, this is be careful what you wish for. We all complained that cable TV was too expensive, and now it's, you know, totally balkanized. And now we got to figure out, no, I need an Amazon subscription, I need a YouTube subscription, I need an Apple subscription, in addition to all the other broadcast channels. So, yeah, it's very difficult to figure out which game is on where nowadays.
Now, I know it sounds silly for a guy like me. It's like, okay, I got to go buy a TV, but I got to make sure now the TV, which will help me out, has those streaming services like a Netflix or a Google or YouTube, just to make sure that I can just switch to that channel and make it easy for me to watch.
Right, I know. And even if you get Roku, which is supposed to help you figure it all out, it still doesn't necessarily connect with everything. So, yeah, these are the challenges that we're all going to face. But you know, this is the last big deal of the NFL rights, you know, sort of for this cycle. Last year, they secured all the broadcast ones, and that included, you know, Amazon for Thursday Night Football. And so now we pretty much have a sense of where it's going to go, at least in terms of the NFL, for the next few years. And there's a big presence online, and it's going to continue to be. A lot of the major broadcast networks, like CBS, have, and NBC have, you know, streaming arms, and so you can also watch games on Peacock or Paramount Plus, and so that's the evolution we're seeing here. And so, fortunately, the NFL is smart enough to do it sort of gradually. They didn't put everything online at once, And so there's just a lot of options for the way people watch.
Thanks again to both Brian Tapana and Chris Palmieri for joining the show. Coming up, we shift to compensation for college athletes and NIL. That's straight ahead on the Bloomberg Business of Sports show from Bloomberg Radio around the world.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
We're going to talk influencer, what that is and what it's all about, and the man that founded it and the chief executive officer of it, Jim Caval. Welcome to the Bloomberg Business of Sports.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's start from the basics. Old man Barr here, what's Influencer mobile app and what's that all about?
Well, Influencer is an app that now more than 100,000 student athletes and also pro athletes have on their phone. And it's purchased by the team they play for, whether it's a pro or college team, as a software piece to help the athlete really build their brand on social media and manage their NIL or name, image, and likeness endorsement business. And so we work pro in college, but we have a big, big piece of our business that's focused on more than 200 college programs, more than 3,000 college teams at the Division I level. And those teams need to provide tech that helps their athletes, A, get content shot of them playing and practicing, because they, as athletes, want to use that content and share it to their social platforms like Instagram and Twitter and Snapchat. And so our app is how those teams deliver all of that content to their athletes so they can share it to social. And that's really the brand building piece of Influencer that we've done since 2017. It's how we got trust from more than 200 college programs and 3,000 college teams across the country before the recent NIL legislation passed, which allowed student athletes starting in July 2021 to make money with their name, image, and likeness. And now Influencer also helps with that. And what we do is really we're the app where student athletes are found, communicated with, contracted with, and paid for all of their NIL transactions from donors, fans, businesses who want to work with them. And we're the reporting tool they use to pay their taxes, and where all the data is for the coaches and compliance officers at each school to use for recruiting and regulatory purposes. So it's been a fun ride so far, and we're excited to be a part of this new NIL era that's began.
So interesting. You were set up before NIL became a thing, before it became something that the athletes could profit off of. Was that the intention? Did you know that that was something that was a possibility when you began this journey?
Yeah, I did. I didn't know when. I can't tell you that, but you know, I've always been an entrepreneur since college. I've built and sold a few businesses. I've had my failures. And probably the biggest thing I learned, and you learned it playing college baseball as I did as well, is you're going to fail, but timing is everything. And the way to decrease the risk is have great timing, right? And so my last business was in fitness. I had a 50-gym chain, and one of our gyms, a member, was the commissioner of the SEC. He still is, Greg Sankey. And he and I
were talking
about the Ed O'Bannon. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Greg was the first person that told me about the Ed O'Bannon case. And so I started to study it. And what I realized was NIL was really not a matter of if, but when. And whenever the when was going to be, it was going to cause a lot of pain and disruption for the college athletics industry. And at that time, 2016, social media was already a very big part of the student-athlete life. And student-athlete brand on social really represents the school's brand. And so we figured out a way to start a company, an influencer, that focused on the student-athlete's social media and gave the school something they could buy to enhance and support the student-athlete's brand growth on social media during their time at the institution, while also helping the institution and the school and their team reach more recruits, reach more fans through the student-athlete. And so by delivering content to athletes in 2017 and beyond, we earned trust from schools to be in a position where, yeah, when NIL ever happens, we want to help with that too. And of course, it took a few years, but then in 2021, it happened, and we were in a position to be there, be a solution for it.
Jim, I wonder if you could talk to us a little bit about how the schools themselves manage their social media presence, manage their brands. Have you seen evolution on that front? I mean, clearly, influencer is paid for by the school itself. Clearly, you would think the school is putting out content and, you know, wants that content sort of to find its way into their individual brands of their individual athletes. I mean, are you finding that they're evolving, that there's talented people at the university that are producing social content, or is that something that is kind of moving and going forward as time goes?
Oh, it's mainstream now. I would say in 2016, when I started working on selling my fitness business and going all in on building influencer, my biggest risk was how much content are schools going to create? How many schools have the staff to produce enough content for us to sell a product that delivers content to athletes? And the ways we countered it back then was partnering with USA Today or Getty Images or some of the credentialed media that are at the events too. So we had content from them for the athletes to use. But over time, every school now is a media company. They have a bunch of content producers per sport churning out content that athletes can use. And in the bigger picture, even of NIL, you know, schools are in the student athlete support business. And while some in the public might think that schools don't work with student athletes, that's really why they exist, right? Higher ed is all about maximizing the potential of a young person, and college athletics should be all about maximizing the potential of student athletes. So having more and more support staff, not just to produce content, but to help answer questions about NIL, to help educate athletes about NIL, and help set them up to really use these skills they're learning from doing some NIL business as a college athlete in their career, so that they left with an opportunity and a foundation to build their career off of, that's a huge way to live out that mission.
There's going to be a big change at the top for the NCAA as president. Outgoing president Mark Emmert stepping down in 2023. Incoming Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker, who is going to wrap up his term in a few weeks. So what do you see as a change from Emmert to Baker?
Well, I think the biggest thing is you know, Baker's proven that he understands the political game at all levels, and he has a bipartisan foundation that's going to allow him to be very relational with everyone in D.C. and become a line between college athletics and the NCAA and Washington, D.C. in ways that the NCAA needs a lot of assistance, especially on the antitrust front. And so I think his ability to come in, understand where the NCAA is today, where it was in the past and how it got to where it is today, but also create a vision of where the NCAA needs to be in the future to stay relevant and be the governing body for college athletics, which will include some antitrust exemption from D.C. I think his ability to do that is probably just as good or better than anyone else. It still leaves the question of, can the NCAA adapt to this future of college athletics and still be the governing body for this new era? But if there was ever a chance to figure that out, this is the person to do that.
Right. Well, that ship might have sailed when it comes to football, but certainly they play an instrumental role in basketball, in college basketball. I'm curious what you think of the different NIL legislation taking place in Congress, whether it's Senator Murphy's or Senator Tuberville's, in conjunction with Senator Manchin. We don't need to get into the specifics of it, but what do you think legislation requires? What at the very least, what does it need to address?
Well, at the very least, it needs to address what I mentioned earlier, which is it needs to address some of the antitrust implications of NCAA governing rules, limiting student athletes in a way that you know is not just, right? So that's the base. But you know what I think about these bills is I think the more that college athletics involves the federal government, first of all, they've got to understand the timeline. I think they are now because things are moving slow, if at all, with any real government support of NIL. They've been asking for a federal NIL bill for a long time, and there's just bigger things, frankly, going on in our country and our world than this issue. The second thing is, once it's NIL, a lot of people in college athletics are worried about that. Just opens up Pandora's box, and a lot of folks who might not even understand how college athletics works might start messing with some other components of college athletics that you know, it's kind of like be careful what you wish for, folks in the college athletics realm by getting DC involved. And there's a lot of people in college athletics that are worried about that. My fear is just that, you know, the way the media has written about college athletics and about student athlete treatment for so long has a lot of people, including student athletes and their families, but also fans and the general public, misunderstanding how much is invested into student athletes and how good student athletes actually have it today between all of the non-taxable dollars they get for cost of attendance, educator-related benefits. If you get a 3.0, you can now get $6,000 a year for educator-related benefits. If you qualify, you get financial aid like a Pell Grant. You get unlimited gear, unlimited food, tuition, and NIL now. And then on top of that, you can be a free agent every year by joining the transfer portal. If we go one step further and some of these bills are calling for employment status to happen for student athletes, you lose a lot of that. And you're paying for the extra pair of sneakers. You're paying for the extra food. You're paying for the extra strength coaches. You're paying tuition. You're not getting a lot of these tax-free dollars. And you could be terminated if you don't perform, let alone the fact that it will affect the funding for Title IX and a lot of the smaller sports, which come from these bigger sports that would be now having payroll for student athletes. So I fear if we go a step further without really thinking it through, we could have some bad things occur for the student athlete, for sports that would be canceled, and a lot of other things. And so hopefully the people writing these bills can study the big picture of college athletics and see that we need to support student athletes more than we are today. We need to continue to evolve that. But we also need to do what we can to make this a unique model that thinks about where college athletics came from and where it needs to go.
Well, Jim, Influencer Now serves, if memory serves me, 200 Div 1 schools, right? And I think you have a directory of nearly 64,000 athletes. And, you know, my question is a simple one. You know, does Influencer connect athletes with the NIL opportunity, or is it more about connecting donors and boosters with the athlete?
It's an and/or. So essentially, we are a tech-first company. We are not a marketplace that has a sales team selling any of these dollars into our system so they can connect with athletes. So what we do is we build exchanges or marketplaces for each school that we work with. And so Michigan has the Victor's Exchange, right? And you can go to the Victor's Exchange if you're a Michigan, you know, donor, fan, an endemic business that supports Michigan athletics. And in there, once you join the Victor's Exchange, you can find every Michigan student athlete right on their influencer app. And you can communicate with them, contract with them, pay them. And there's no fees taken from any deal that comes through the Victor's Exchange because Michigan pays us to build that exchange for their student athletes so that they can keep all the money. And that model is what we do across the board for all of our institutions so that we can maximize what ends up in the student athlete's wallet and really have one focused client paying us, which is the school. And so on top of our content delivery software we've had since 2017 with the school, delivering content to the athletes, we now build these custom exchanges for each school so that they have one system of record for all of the dollars endemic to their school to flow through to the student athlete. And that way they can track everything happening from a compliance standpoint. Their coaches can use that data in recruiting conversations in a compliant manner to show real results happening with their current roster. And the student athlete can use all that data to get a 1099 at the end of the year and pay their taxes.
You brought up an interesting point. I know we're running out of time. I apologize. But you brought up a point about if they're not careful how the bill is written, the student athlete can be cut from the team. Now, right now, I mean, obviously, if the student athlete doesn't go out and, you know, run around the parking lot in a Big Bird suit, you know, he'll be all right. But, you know, if now it comes down to performance, yeah, he might sit on the bench or she, but they're still going to be part of the team for the most part. But you're saying now that they could be cut if they're not careful.
They could be cut if they don't perform. If they're employees, they'll be able to be terminated. And then sports will be cut because funding that comes from football to fund a lot of these sports will now be used for payroll. And so, you know, am I saying a school with 16 sports is going to cancel a bunch of sports? Not as much as I am saying a school like Ohio State that has more than 30 sports is going to have to figure out a new budget to keep all 30 plus sports, right? So, you know, these are realities that we've got to all look at. There's nobody that's more about athlete empowerment than me. It's
why I sold my successful fitness business, took a huge risk, and started building Influencer before NIL started. But I want this to be done the right way for the student athlete and their future to be maximized, not in a way that's about helping the 1% of student athletes while hurting a great majority of the others.
Jim Caval, an interesting perspective, founder and chief executive officer of Influencer. Jim, thank you so much for joining us on the Bloomberg Business of Sports, and thank you for your knowledge, sir.
Thanks for having me, guys. Enjoyed it.
This has been the Bloomberg Business of Sports podcast. We explore the big money issues in the world of sports. I'm Michael Barr. You can follow me on Twitter at Big Barr Sports.
And I'm on Twitter at Scarlett Fu.
And I'm on Twitter at DSassHour.
And hey, if you have a calendar right in front of you and you just need the days of the week, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays, that's where the podcasts take place, and download them wherever you get your podcasts.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.